Pod. 22 Red Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Huh. So you're in Berlin then, yeah?
Yeah, I've been here for 11 years. A bit of a long time.
What took you over there?
Well, to begin with, the rent was much cheaper. Yeah. we played in Germany a lot. I liked it. And then, 11 years ago, the rent in Berlin was so cheap, I just moved it for that, really. So I could sort of live off paintings and stuff like that. And then I met someone here and we had a kid. So now I'm a dad. So I'm here forever, really. I love it. I love Berlin. I'm glad I'm here.
Yeah, nice one. Yeah, my girlfriend's brother moved over there a few years ago, and I couldn't believe how cheap it was, especially because we were living in London at the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was before I came here, really. It was like, oh, this is nuts. I was in Nuremberg, and I was saying to like this band, the Robocop crowd, I was like, oh, Germany's lovely. I'm going to move to Nuremberg. And they're like, no, not for you. Like, Berlin or Hamburg. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, and Berlin was, mega cheap. I love it here. So, yeah.
Go right back, really. Like, can you give us an idea of how you started the band and went from there to getting a record deal kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I wanted to be in a band forever, really, since I was a kid. And I had a band in Bournemouth, where I grew up, called the Art Goblins. And everybody in that band kept leaving me and going to university. And the Art Goblins were getting younger and younger, and I was getting older and older. I thought, this can't happen. So eventually I followed Nicky Biscuit, the keyboard player in the Art Goblins. He moved to London and I thought, that sounds exciting. So I just sort of went with him and tried to start a band there, really. And I thought I'd do the Art Goblins. That didn't really work out. And then I spent about a year getting drunk and going to parties and demanding that people be in a band with me. And I can't really sing or anything. And I was sort of lying to people about it. Oh, I can sing like Aretha Franklin. And they find out that I couldn't and it wouldn't work out. And then I met this guy, Christian Chiller, at a party at our friend Jaconi's house after they played. And I drunkenly told him I wanted to be in a band. He's like, oh, me too. I'm a guitar player. And kind of from that, it started, really. I have lots of funny ideas and stuff, and I'm not very good at getting things started. And he was really organizational. So like he like made his next door neighbor learn the bass guitar to be our bass guitar player. And then I realized that I can't sing and I needed like someone on my side that knew me. And my friend Ian, who'd been in the band in Bournemouth, had just moved to London. So I convinced him to join. And then we have a drummer for ages. And then we found a drummer like drunk on the tube. Mike became our drummer from that, really. And so, we were like a real hodgepodge of people. Like, I didn't really know Chris when I met him. And then he taught Freddie the bass. Well, she knew the bass anyway, but she became a bass player just to be in the band. Yeah, and we got together. What was the question? How did we get a record deal? We all came together. It was like a chaos, really. And then what happened? We had a song that was I was lucky. The first song we sort of did properly together was this song called Formed a Band. And that was like our demo to like get gigs and stuff. And Chris got it on a compilation for a New Cross sampler thing. And then Rough Trade heard it, and the demo became the single on Rough Trade. And it's weird because the demo, I'm making up the words as I go along, really. I had the chorus form the band, but everything else like made up, like on the spot, really. Like when I say it, like, yes, this is my singing voice, I say that in the song. It's because when we first started recording it, he's my friend now, Keith Top of the Pops. He stopped the recording, was like, is everything okay? You were right, mate, what's wrong? This is my singing voice. And it became a lyric in the song. So it's like, it was that improvised. So it's funny. Yeah, and out of that, we got like a one single record deal with Rough Trade. We had to go away and write the B-side. We didn't really have many other songs. We wrote Bad Weekend in a weekend. Oh, no, we need the B-side. Shit, quick. Yeah. And then after that, I think people kind of thought we were a novelty act or something because of the way I sing and what the song's about. So it took about another year to find a different record label.
I think I appreciate probably your music and where you're coming from more now I'm a bit older. I think in terms of like, the kind of self-awareness and not taking it too seriously. Was that something you always intended, obviously, with the band?
Things like Formed a Band was just, I was genuinely very excited to be in a band. I've been trying to be in a band for ages, and I hadn't really been, I hadn't thought it all the way through. So I'm like, I want to be in a band, I want to be on stage, I want to be showing off. But I hadn't thought of the lyrics yet. I hadn't done that next bit. So yeah, it was just writing. It was just that really, and also with Form the Band especially, I was just trying to convince everybody else to be in a band with me. It was like a speech, really. I can do this. I can do this. But I think that lots of the bands I like are sort of self-referential stuff, and the humour I like and stuff is like that. And I liked sort of David Devon and his Spirit Wife, and he often sings about himself in his songs, but it didn't seem that strange to me, really, I guess. And that was the first song. And then later this all became more autobiographical, I guess, but always self-depreciating with a bit of humour, I would say. Conversational. I like songs to be conversational. I want them to be a conversation. That was definitely a plan.
And obviously, like you mentioned, the vocal sounds like quite unique at that time. But was it inspired by anyone else, or was it purely just because you didn't fancy yourself as a singer?
I really did think I was kind of, to begin with, I really did think I was singing. It wasn't until we got like reviews that said I was anti-rap or that I was shouting. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I like people that sort of sing. I like Jonathan Richman, and I like Cutting Myself with Sex Machine songs, are paying these guys. They have, well, I thought they were singing too. Maybe they're also not singing. But the so I kind of thought I was singing like in their kind of style. So when I started reading reviews that said I was shouting or speaking, I was kind of surprised. I didn't realize it was that distinctive. Like, we always got comparisons to The Fool. I mean, I knew a bit about The Fool, but they weren't really like a big influence or anything on me. You know, like I wish I could sing like Bessel from David Devon or something, you know. So it was yeah, it's just necessity, really. I think I tried to play so many instruments when I was younger, like the guitar, the keyboard. I played the steel drums at school, the euphonium. But I couldn't do any of that stuff, really. And I realised, I think, being the singer is easier. I can just, I definitely got a voice, even if it's bad. But yeah, it wasn't like an intentional, like, yeah, I sort of ended up just being the singer because it's all I could do, really. And then the singer has to write the lyrics, and so that came next, I guess.
And did kind of like the stage presence kind of come naturally? Like, I was watching your performance today in Chicago, the album you did there, live album. And
that was a trick. You know, we got tricked for that. We were drunk, and we signed a contract just after we played the show, like excited. And they owned that album. We gave it to them because they tricked us. I mean, I've never seen it actually, but yeah.
I did wonder why. The full thing was on YouTube and it wasn't under an official channel or anything.
It doesn't belong to us. We got drunk. It was like the second gig we played in America. We were just so excited. Like, hey, we can turn this into a thing for you. Like, yeah, we'll sell whatever you want. Like, our manager, like, what have you done? But yeah, that was like our second gig in America. Okay. But I wasn't, to begin with, I was really so shy on stage. Like the first five or six Art Brut shows, I guess, like around London. I'd like people would give us a big round of applause, and I'd say, "Don't be sarcastic," you know. Or like, I was like playing with my hair. I was like making lots of sort of like self-depreciating jokes about how we couldn't play and stuff. And then actually, we played with, I can't remember what they were called. It was a Jet tribute band somewhere in London. It wasn't just Jet. It was like they were a covers band, and their lead singer was so charismatic, and like, you know, and even though I didn't like the music, I was like, oh, okay, that guy's kind of cool. But not cool, but like, I understood. It just made me realize that it was like, people don't want to watch a shy, nervous guy on stage. They want to watch a guy that's like confident and jumping around. And after that, I just always tried to be more confident, or more like myself, really. I'm quite confident in life, I guess. So to be like more, just own it a bit more, I think. So it took a while, but those early Art Brut shows, I was like apologizing and like had my back to the audience and was just making jokes about how we were shit all the time on stage, which is not really what you're supposed to do. It took like seeing a covers band to realise how to act really on stage, I guess.
No, I was enjoying it, like in between the songs at that Chicago gig. I think you ended one song and you just said, any questions?
Yeah, that was a good one, yeah.
I thought it was funny, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the bands I like are the bands that talk in between their songs. You know, like, I mean, I grew up loving Pulp, you know, going to watch Pulp play a lot and stuff. And Jarvis is always talking in between the songs. And again, like David Devon, and just bands that I like seem to be bands that have a bit of a natter, you know. I can hear the songs at home. I want to hear what the guy's on about. I'm just emulating the bands that I like, I guess.
I think you seem to include like different things when you're playing live. Like in that gig, I think you started with Enter Sandman and then you go into Form the Band, which I was enjoying as well.
Yeah, we did that a lot. That became a thing. We'd interweave. I guess also because we've been playing so much for like 3 or 4 years, like we had to keep it interesting for us as well. So we'd put in like, yeah, so we played, we'd always begin the set with Form the Band, I guess, by then. Then we'd do different riffs, Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue. We were driving around in our van listening to like 80s hair metal and metal and stuff. So it all sort of worked its way into our set. We used to play like in Good Weekend, we drop songs into like Kids in America or Jumpin' Jack Flash. It's fun. I mean, so much of what I sing about is about record collections and being like an indie kid and stuff. It's funny just to drop in little nods to things, other people's lyrics, bits of riffs. It's fun.
And then songs like Bang Bang Rock and Roll. Was that a bit of a comment on the whole indie scene at the time in terms of, I didn't like Velvet Underground first time round, never mind second time round?
I mean, some of that is just this fun bit of rhymes. Yeah. Velvet Underground the second time around. But some of it also, I mean, there was another song, Bad Weekend, where I'm like moaning about not reading the enemy in ages. And it's true. Like there's that, it was like New Rock Revolution or something. It was the Vines and the Strokes and all this kind of stuff. And I was just, from where I was looking at things, things just start getting a bit interesting, you know, with the Parkinsons and McCluskey and, you know, Akira Colt and stuff. And then all of a sudden the Strokes came along and it was like, oh, it's Stanton Boys. And, you know, it just sort of got boring again, I think, for me. And I was, you know, probably jealous as well. Like, you know, 20, 22 or something, grumpy about it. And they kept getting compared to the Velvet Underground. And I was like, it's not, is it? It's just, you know, the Velvet Underground are like more, a lot more interesting than that. But the song's a bit about that too, really. I guess I don't like that sort of laddish culture being compared to the Rebel Underground was kind of strange to me, I think. But I used to stop that song in the middle sometimes, live to explain it. Like, stop. And then I'd talk about it. And I'd always say the same thing about how, look, I love the Rebel Underground. This song isn't about that. It's about bands that sort of copy them and aren't as good and have no original ideas of their own and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes the band supporting us wouldn't know that I say it every night, and they'd be like, he's talking about us. People would like think I was like talking about them. I think if you thought that about yourself, that was more to do with you than me. I think I was like another band. I think we did it in when we played in New York, we played at like the Tribeca, I think the first time. And I did it then, and I stopped it, and I sort of slagged off the Strokes for joke in the middle. It's fun, isn't it, when you're in New York? And they were there, like three of them were there and walked out, apparently. Which is a shame. It's like, I mean, I don't hate the Strokes or anything. I bet they've got some good jokes. I'd like to have met the Strokes and hang out a bit, I guess. But yeah, I didn't even really think about it. Just, yeah, the Strokes, make jokes. And then someone told me, I think they were here, some of them, and they left when you did that. Oh. Okay, whoops, that's fun, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's better to be having a laugh in it than trying to imitate someone or anything, I guess.
Yeah, it's got to be your own in it. That's what it's about, I think.
Now, yeah, you mentioned NME, and I read that you grouped into like an what they called an art wave group of bands, like the Rakes, Block Party. But that was something that you were trying to avoid, even with the band's name, which kind of refers to outsider art, and you felt you were more punk. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. Well, I saw it coming. I love Franz Ferdinand and the Rakes, I should say. They're brilliant, but the I could see it coming, the art thing, really. And I was like, we're not that. Like, you know, I want to be like outside of that. I mean, art brew means outsider art, really. Like, didn't go to art school, you know, untrained. It's like lunatics and people that make art without realizing it. And I thought, that's us. When I first started, when the band first started, I'd say, hello, we're art brew. And I don't think everybody in the band knew what that meant, but I knew that it meant like what I was saying. They were like, yeah, that we outsider artists. And I mean, the name itself was to sort of not be part of that. You can't, I mean, it's such a stupid thing to moan about being lumped into a scene or something. I mean, it helped us, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's weird for us, I think, because we're a bit too rocking and punky for like Maximo Park and like the Rakes and Franz Ferdinand, but we're a bit too clever to be like straight ahead rocky stuff. You're sort of in the middle, really, I think. I found we had more in common at the end with bands like I like the Hold Steady a lot in America. And people were saying, we toured with them. And I read reviews, it was like, oh, like we're the same, we're like an English Hold Steady. It's like, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense. We're kind of barroom rock with like clever lyrics, I guess. So yeah. But putting art in the name didn't make everybody think we were an art band. I mean, to be fair, we do sing about modern art and, you know, that song's 20 minutes long now. And even at the time, it was like,
I would talk about different types of art. I'd be like, "Ah, Brute, play me the sound of abstract expressionism," and then like talk about abstract expressionism for 5 minutes. So I guess I can't really complain about being labelled an art band when I was doing that all the time.
You mentioned the name and the Art Brute franchise thing. I think I got my head around it. Is it where people would just call themselves Art Brute, say 22, and then do their own thing, or would it be like your songs they were doing?
It was kind of a mix. So I decided, again, like I have these stupid ideas, and then Christian Tiller would like enable them. So like, I had this idea that Art Brute was the last good band name anyone could ever have, which is quite vain, I guess. Like we've taken the last good band name. I was kind of joking. So now we have to share it with everybody. So if anyone else starts a band, they have to be called Art Brute and pick a number. And then it became this franchise system. And I just sort of said it. And then I didn't really have a laptop or anything at the time, but Chris had, we had a website and Chris put it on there. And then we started getting like cover songs. Like this, the first one was like Art Brute, like Pi, 3 point, blah, blah, whatever. He lived in West Virginia. He covered, like formed a band. And then there was like a Russian Art Brute that were writing their own songs. And then there were loads of Art Brutes that like, Art Brute 4 I met and became friends with. Art Brute 7 were pretty nice, became friends with them too. Like it got really out of hand. Like Art Brute 7 were on, sent me an email and a link, and they'd been on like some business like Forbes TV or something in America talking about franchises. Now they're a franchise of Art Brute. And then when we were back from tour, and I used to live with Mike and Jasper, and we were all kind of tired in our rooms. And then Mike heard on the radio, there's an Art Brute Battle of the Bands happening, like in Kentish Town. And like, 5 or 6 different Art Brutes, like Art Brute 7, Art Brute 4, I think, Art Brute 10 maybe, lots of different Art Brutes, all had an Art Brute Battle of the Bands, but without telling us, we weren't invited or anything at this place in Kentish Town. We only heard about it because it was on XFM. I think Art Brute 7 won. Art Brute 7, their trick was they sang Formed a Band Over Modern Art, or Modern Art Over Formed a Band. I mean, I couldn't do that, so if we'd entered, we would have lost, I think, to Art Brute 7. But yeah, it was just like a funny idea that got really out of hand. And I still meet people that have badges. Look, I was Art Brute 19, I was Art Brute 103. Yeah, it's funny. Art Brute 25, they were Dutch, I think. Yeah, Art Brute 4, we became friends with Art Brute 4. Art Brute 4 came to London for like an anti-racism thing and sort of stayed in my house and became friends. I still know Art Brute 4 now. It was just like a funny idea that sort of got way out of hand. And then We Are Scientists became Art Brute. I think they're Art Brute. I'm going to get it wrong. Sorry, Keith. Art Brute 44, I think. So that makes us We Are Scientists too. I guess we covered each other's songs. Yeah, it was a funny idea that sort of got out of hand. I like it when people take things I've said and go nuts with it. It was good. I miss those guys, the franchises. It's good.
Yeah, did you have a good relationship with the We Are Scientists? Because I saw they covered Bang Bang Rock and Roll in the style of Velvet Underground. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. We were on tour with them. That was meant to be for a 7-inch in America. And they did that. They covered us in the style of Velvet Underground. And we covered The Great Escape by them. And we thought it'd be really funny to tag the end of Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd on it, like note for note, so it goes dan 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 dan, and it becomes Freebird at the end. And we just signed up this big record company in America, and we were in a really expensive studio, and we spent all of our time doing that instead of like making news. They came in to see what we were up to, and they were like, "I don't think you're allowed to do that. I think that belongs to Lynyrd Skynyrd." Like, it'd be fine, it'd be fine. And then we tried to press it to be like given away. They all sold at the gigs. And then it's going to wouldn't let us. Like, there's a big publishing issue with it. So we spent all this time and money making this cover of We Are Scientists. It took 11 years for us to get the publishing clearance. It came out with our best of or something. But yeah, we did our first. Well, I became friends with Keith. My ex-girlfriend was in a band called The Chalets, and they toured with We Are Scientists and the Kaiser Chiefs. So I was on that tour, like just hanging out with Paula. And then I met Keith like in the, they're quite famous, the Kaiser Chiefs. Yeah, they had a canteen or whatever, like they had food everywhere. And I met Keith there. We became friends, and then we toured. Yeah, whenever they're in town, we say hello. I love We Are Scientists. I think they're great.
Then yeah, just going back to labels, like obviously getting that single deal with Rough Trade must have been a big deal at the time. Were you disappointed that they didn't take on for an album, or did he just kind of get on with it kind of thing?
disappointed, really. I mean, I love Rough Trade. It's the best one, isn't it? To be honest, it's good. They gave us our contracts and they said, you should show these to a lawyer before you sign them. We did. We took them to the Dublin Castle and showed them to everybody in the pub. And then just signed them. Yeah, there you go. No lawyer look at that. We'll be fine. Gave them back the next day. It's great. I mean, we wouldn't exist for that Rough Trade single. But the, we would, but no, we are. But the, yeah, it was, yeah, it was disappointing. They kept flirting with us, you know, but they came to see us and they're like, oh yeah, we think we can do it. And then we can't do it. We can do it. And they came to this garage show we played. It was really good. One of our really good early shows. And they decided then, they said I was too childish. They said our group were too childish to be signed to Rough Trade. Which, I mean, I love the Moldy Peaches a lot. But, you know, Kimmy dresses like a rabbit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's quite childish too. It's like, I mean, yeah, I was upset. But we ended up with Fierce Panda in the end. That was okay. I mean, I love Fierce Panda too. I have lots of Fierce Panda records in my collection.
Yeah, obviously, I read that you were... release a single with Fierce Panda. And in terms of the song Emily Kane, I read something like it would have got to the top 40. I think it got to 41, but you had a bit of a fail with iTunes or something.
Yeah, they didn't. Half of the, like, well, not half, but like, I like downloads counting as the singles chart was really new, maybe even that week or the week before or something was very new. And they hadn't registered some of them. I think if you download it from the album and not as a single, then something like this. So like they accidentally didn't register. I can talk about this now. I was very angry about this. I'm done. But yeah, why not? Well, no, my dream was to go on Top of the Pops, you know, and then that would have really helped. But the yeah, so like lots of the singles that were downloaded didn't count. They hadn't been registered properly. And we only missed out, apparently, I've been told by a few people, we missed out by one sale. So
wow.
If some of those had counted, we'd have been in the top 40. And that's it. Then you're on Top of the Pops or Tools Holland or something. Yeah, it's okay. It's, I mean, it didn't work out with Emily Kane either, so it's quite nice. They made the apple. So it's kind of poetic, you know?
Yeah. Now, we've talked to a few people who, in hindsight, wish they'd kind of pushed more to get on Top of the Pops. I think the Cribs kind of turned it down and they said they regret that.
Yeah, but the Cribs turned down going on Hollyoaks too, yeah. Like, what are you doing? That's brilliant. I'd have loved to be on Hollyoaks. Yeah, I mean, I like all that. I always thought it was, because also we're quite an unusual band. I mean, the Cribs too. I think the Cribs on Top of the Pops would have been brilliant. I'd love to have seen that, you know.
What was the Hollyoaks story, sorry?
Yeah, no, the I mean, it was, I've been told this, that the Cribs were offered the chance to be in Hollyoaks. Like, they'd be playing on Hollyoaks, like, as a band.
Oh, right.
And they turned that down too. And I heard that, I was like, what the fuck, what the crap? Like, I'd love to have been in Hollyoaks. I mean, Hollyoaks played, they played Crib songs too, but they played like our song Fight somewhere in Hollyoaks at some point. And that's like the first time my little sister really realised that my band was sort of doing okay. She's like, you were in Hollyoaks. Like, yeah, like Frank Black producing her album. Like, I'm in America, but like, the thing that really impressed him was Skins and Hollyoaks. But yeah, but I love that. I'd love to have been more involved in like, yeah, like I love things like Hollyoaks and Top of the Pops. I'd loved it if our group could have been on some of those shows. It'd have been great. I think I like all that. You know, I embrace all that kind of stuff.
I assume you must have been featured quite a lot on things like MTV2 at the time, though.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, when Form the Band came, we just didn't know what we were doing. So, like the week before it came out, Rough Trade were like, "Oh, where's the video?" Well, we haven't got a video. What are you talking about? And then, like, our managers at the time, this guy called Z and Daniel, they went that weekend and made the video for us, like a cartoon. And I think that got played on MTV2 a bit. I didn't have cable or anything at the time. I was living in a bed sit. So I didn't really see it. But we'd be at parties, though, and, like, MTV2 would be on in the background, and we'd be like, what, go on. It'd be great. Like, go on. But the... yeah, and we were so, even like with Rough Trade when Form the Band came out, they had to phone us up on the day, because Form the Band had been a free download on our website, you know, to get gigs and stuff. And we forgot to take it down. We had no video. And then when it came out, Rough Trade phoned us up and were like, you need to take down the free the free download from your website because we're trying to sell it. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, we just didn't know what we were doing, really. We're such a young band. We'd only been together, you know. Like, on the first album, that's all of our songs. That's every song we had written was our first album.
You mentioned a few bands, but did you have good relationships with any other bands that were, like, kind of part of that that scene back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the Rakes were good friends with the Rakes I mean, then we both got busy touring and stuff. But like, one of the gigs that Rough Trade came to see us play was with the Rakes in somewhere in East London, and they're amazing. Like, I love the Rakes. I mean, I think I like their first album a lot, but when we saw them, they were a lot more raw and strange when I first saw the Rakes. They had a block with them on stage. They brought this block on stage, and they were all standing on it and like doing weird stuff, like posing and doing this. This block was like a central part of the thing. So, what's this band about? This is amazing. It was a bit like, I mean, their album's a really good pop album, but it was like edgier and rawer the first time I saw them. It was great. But most of our friends were really, we were part of this New Cross scene thing. Like, New Cross was a thing for a bit. And it's weird because I moved to London to like be in a band. So I moved to Camden. And then, well, I thought bands lived. And then all of a sudden it turns out you have to go to New Cross all the time. So I'd often be like, yeah, the Boyfriends and the Violets and the Long Blondes, but down a lot from Sheffield. Keith Top of the Pops. That's how I met him. He recorded our first single. He was there a lot. Like, if all that anything was meant to be a scene, that New Cross scene was really actually a scene, I'd say. We go to each other's gigs and stuff, and I'm friends with loads of those guys now, you know. Besides that, yeah, I mean, there are lots of bands we played with. We became really good, like the Fades and Jaconi, and my friend Keith Top of the Pops, who owns a studio. He sort of became like a central tenant for all these bands that we sort of became friends with. That was like our own little scene, really. That was great. And then besides that, I guess I was down, you know, Art Rocker a lot, down in the Buffalo Bar. So yeah, Maxima Park I saw there. We talked with them a bit. I'm friends with them, I guess. Yeah, I mean, all those bands, really. Like, more the art rocker side of stuff, I would say, than I wasn't really friends with the others or anything, I would say.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because I'm sure it was a tongue-in-cheek comment maybe, but I read at one of your gigs, you said, stay clear of Pete Docherty and the others.
Yeah, I didn't like the whole... Yeah, I didn't really like... I don't really... It's not really my... I don't like the others really very much. But the... I think it wasn't... I don't know, I didn't like that whole crack kind of... I love that First Libyans record, I'm going to say. And yeah, but I didn't like the whole... It got a bit weird, didn't it? All that crack stuff around that scene and Whitechapel and stuff. And it used to depress me. And, you know, I'm just a mouthy guy. So, I used to say that, stay away from Alan McGee, stay away from Pop Turns, all this kind of stuff. Because, you know, the end of My Little Brother is stay off the crack. Yeah, so, and then I would give some examples of some people on crack to stay away from. Like, I guess it's what I was doing. I used to always say it. And then I felt bad because Alan McGee came to see us in South by Southwest and wrote a really nice thing in The Guardian about how, like, we're one of the only bands worth seeing and stuff. Like, I'm glad you didn't see the end of My Little Brother when I shouted to stay away from it. Yeah, I was just really mouthy. I mean, I think the band started so quickly. And then I'd say those things anyway in my private life. You know, like, I used to read The Enemy and moan about the bands and stuff. But I just carried on doing that, even though when I was being interviewed by it, I guess. So things like that went on. Yeah, I never really got along with the others, actually. Yeah, I like Johnny. We have David Devont in common. But yeah, I don't think me and Dominic could be friends.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Docherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Yeah, just a quick one about Maxima Park, because I read a quote from you, funny story from Glastonbury, where I think you were watching Maxima Park, and someone came up to you and said, "Are you the lead singer from Maxima Park?" And you're like, you must be very unaware of what's going on right now. Yeah,
that sounds like something might happen. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we played with Maxima Park a lot. I mean, they took us, we played a gig with them in Russia, like in Moscow, I think. And then we got along really well. And then we played, yeah, we did like, we did their, it must have been their first album. So we played like, they played like they did like Shepherd's Bush, and they did like this story. They did like all the big venues in town, you know. And we played the Shepherd's Bush one with them after the tour. And they were leaving, and I thought they all had pizzas with them. You know, oh, I guess a slice, we're starving. Go on, we're a hungry support band. And they're like, they're really embarrassed. And they're like, oh, Eddie. And they opened the boxes, and it was gold discs. They were being given gold discs, not pizzas. Like, oh, well, well deserved. But it was, yeah. Now, those guys are nice and humble and brilliant, I think. Makes it up.
And then around, yeah, 2005, I saw you on tour with Oasis for a few gigs.
Yeah, that was great.
How did that come about? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, well, we were in doing this, they do this weird thing in Norway where you play five nights in the same venue. It's this strange. Can you hear the ice cream van?
It's got a little bit.
Yeah, so we were in Norway playing like this weird run of five shows in the same venue. And halfway through it, we got a phone call saying Oasis want you to like open their first three shows in Europe or something. So we had to get like a night train. We had to cancel the last three gigs in Norway. And everyone was so cool, like, Oasis, of course, you go. Like, it's, you know, like, that's exciting. It was really exciting. And then, yeah, and then we got on a night train. And then, yeah. And then we sort of woke up in Hamburg and we had to play the show. But Oasis were really friendly and nice, you know. Like Liam stood side of the stage every night and was like cheering us on. It was in the sound check and stuff. We played Modern Art and he told Okatatek, fucking have it, that's their best one. It's like Liam Gallagher's favourite song is by us, Modern Art, which is pretty good. And then afterwards, we were kind of shy of speaking to them, I guess, you know, because it's Oasis. They're not, they're more than a band, aren't they? It's like, they're like a red phone box or a policeman's helmet. I mean, they're like a thing, like an institution as opposed to a band now, I guess. And so I was scared to speak to them. And I said, I used to stand very still on stage during our song, Moving to LA. I'd like point towards Los Angeles and not move and stand very still. And he stands very still in one of their songs. So I said to him, like, to break the ice, hey, Liam, I stand still, you stand still. We're both really good at standing still. He's like, yeah, I'm the fucking master of standing still. And then he didn't move like nearly 3 minutes. He just stood completely still. I had no idea what to do. It was amazing. And then later after that, I told the story so many times, but like I told Liam, like, it's weird, you know, like us supporting you is a bit like half man, half biscuit supporting you too. You know, it feels a bit strange being here. And Liam was like, our kid. He really said, our kid, by the way, I'm not making it up. to Noel. He likes Half Man, Half Biscuit. And apparently, like, they used to share a room together at some point, Liam and Noel. And Noel would listen to Half Man, Half Biscuit. And then they both started singing The Trumpton Riots by Half Man, Half Biscuit. It's like, I thought I was having like some sort of nervous breakdown. This is like, I wish just to sing me The Trumpton Riots by Half Man, Half Biscuit. This is very strange. So yeah, they were super nice, actually, Oasis. And it's weird, I didn't used to... You know, growing up in Bournemouth and stuff, I was very into Pulp and Blur and that end of it. And anything laddie, I didn't really like. Those guys used to beat us up for the weekend, you know. Like, I go out in a suit and makeup and get punched by Oasis fans. So for a long time, I didn't like any of that stuff. And my friend Keith, a couple of pops, convinced me that Oasis were really good. So by the time we played with Oasis, it was like, oh, this is great. I mean, that night, we played with Oasis. It was massive. It was like, what, 7,500 people or something? We got really drunk and we went out the front afterwards and sang along to Rock and Roll Star. At the top of our voices. That was really good. That was a very good day. Yeah, it was great. We couldn't really believe it. You know?
I saw you said something like, Liam gets changed 4 or 5 times a day, which I thought was quite
funny. It was loads. He was like, yeah, we're like, oh, that'll be his stage outfit now. And it wasn't. It was like in a different one. Always wearing different sunglasses. He looked super cool every time. What a pop star. And they had catering as well, like really nice, dark, and like delicious food everywhere. Like, here you go, Liam, and he just always has like a bacon and egg sandwich. They made like just for him, like off the menu. Here you go, Liam. Like, he wasn't having any dessert. That's kind of cool. Yeah, what a pop star.
Magazine covers. I saw you're on the front cover of the German Rolling Stone. Did you always have quite a good relationship with Germany?
Yeah, it was. I guess it was the first place where we started doing all right, really. We were on, because we were on Fierce Panda, so the album was really only out in the UK, and then it got licensed sort of slowly across Europe. So like, so the one after that was, we were on Cargo with Fierce Panda in Germany, and that's when it really started taking off, really. Yeah, we played festivals and stuff, and then, yeah. Yeah, I was on the cover of Rolling Stone. It was very strange. I was still living in like a damn bedsit, you know, like in London at the time, like no money. And flying into Germany and seeing my face like peering out at me from all these racks on the front cover of Rolling Stone. But it was good. It was a very exciting time. It always felt like a bit like a dream. Like none of that feels real. Like, and everything was happening so fast. Like now you're playing this big gig, and now you're supporting these bands. And just, yeah, a very strange time.
Yeah, we had Charlotte from the Subways on, who said, you know, their biggest place to play now is Germany in terms of fan bases. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think they're quite loyal to bands in Germany and stuff, I think. And also what I like about that in Germany is, like, in England, the enemy would ask you, like, what's your favourite biscuit? Or, you know, what do you think about block pie? And then you move to, like, you come to Germany and their questions would be like really intense questions about your lyrics and your music, I mean, like a baptism of fire. So this Emily Kane, are you using this form of blah, 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 blah? You know, like there's a lot more scrutiny on everything here. But I like that. We survived that. We got past the test of the German interviews.
Yeah, with Emily Kane, I saw you said about an American audience as well. They kind of got it in a different way to a British audience. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think everywhere outside of the UK, really. I think in England, we're quite cynical people, you know. Me too, you know. So people would see a song like Emily Kane and be like, oh, are you joking? Or is she not real? Was it like a Jill or John thing or something? And then we get to America or Germany, and people would just say, oh, you must have really loved her to write that song about her. You know, people just got it more. And I think, yeah, after that, really, that song made all my writing became a lot more autobiographical after that. It's just a nice feeling to connect with people on the thing. You know, like that. That's the first one, really, where I was like, oh, this feels nice. Like we're having a conversation about something.
In terms of magazine covers, whose idea was it to imitate the Beth Ditto one?
Well, that was Art Rocker to begin with. Art Rocker wanted me to be naked on the cover sort of around about the same time. And then it didn't happen with Art Rocker. I think someone at the Enemy heard about it and were like, do you mind doing it for us? And I was like, nah, it'd be fine. And then as the day got closer and closer, I think I got a bit more nervous. But then my friend, like in a hotel room, we were on tour at the time, in Leeds, I think, maybe, in a hotel room. And Andrew Kendall, who I knew a bit, was the photographer. And I'm not naked, really. I'm wearing like a very thin, flesh-coloured thong. That kind of partially covers me. And I, you know, it was half an hour of posing and stuff. And I think I got used to being naked quicker than everybody else in the room got used to me being naked. And the other person, I was like, yeah, this is fine, I don't mind. And I could see him going like, oh, dear God, like hiding his eyes. But yeah, it was, I mean, it's a funny thing to have done, isn't it? To be naked in the Enemy. That was,
yeah, it's great to look at now. Yeah, it's funny.
Someone in America, I saw there, I'm kind of friends with, they had the picture like blown up as like almost like an oil painting in that. Is that, they tagged me in a photo. I'm like, oh, that's, no, without the Enemy being, you know, just the naked. Oh, dear. Yeah, funny. Sometimes I meet people. I met someone here in Germany, and they were like, "Ah, oh, I used to have that poster on my wall." What? That's so weird. I was like naked. But yeah, it's very strange.
Then, yeah, in terms of the second album, you moved on to Mute Records, which was owned by EMI, I think. Was that more of a major label type of vibe on that?
Yeah, well, we signed to, like, I think they're called labels. Because the album, the first album came out so like individually, and then an EMI label bought the first album off us, so it came out again everywhere with bonus tracks. We toured that for like 2 years, and then out of the EMI label, came Mute and Labels and a few other people. We were like, finally, we're on a major label. You know, we don't mind selling out our brute. We were like very tired of being poor and having no money for videos or anything. We're like, finally, now we have a video made that's going to be really good, and we can like have an advert maybe in a magazine. We'd never had any of that stuff on Fierce Panda, a little bit now and again. And but of course, that's when EMI went bankrupt. So we signed to EMI, and it was like, we came to visit their offices in Germany, me and Mikey, to do some press. And it was a massive, huge office for like hundreds of people, and there were about 9 people working there. And we went to like get some food from the machine, you know, like like a chocolate bar, and that was empty. And then everyone was really depressed that worked for EMI. Yeah, we'll take you out to 8mm, this bar. And we went there thinking, oh, they'll buy us drinks because they're EMI. And then we ended up buying them drinks. So it was like, it was pretty depressing. We signed to EMI at like exactly the wrong moment. And and it wasn't, they didn't really help, I don't think. Mute were wonderful. Mute in the UK. I wish we could have signed to Mute, really. I mean, just with them. Daniel Miller came to the studio and stuff. It was like, we went to their Christmas party and met. It was, they were really great, Mute. But the overall company, EMI, that was sort of in charge of Europe and everything, they were not so good, I think. But they were bankrupt. There was no one working there. It was like being on a ghost ship.
And was it them who released a single without telling you or something?
Yeah, they released... Well, we made... I think about this now. We were complaining a lot about them. And they didn't give us any money or anything. And then I realised recently, there's a video for this song, Pump Up the Volume. But the single never really... didn't properly come out, really. But the that video, we were in Australia. So we flew a guy from Los Angeles to Australia to like make the video. That's quite a waste of money, really. I guess so maybe they were spending some money on us. But the so we didn't realize, they didn't tell us that they were releasing it. You know, we were like planning some B-sides for it or something. And then we were in the car, in the van, sorry, like driving to a gig. And Dermot O'Leary played it on Radio 2. But this is the new Art Brut single, Download Only, coming out in like, what? It's like really strange. That was the last straw, really. I think we were like, they're just incompetent. They're not, you know, we don't have any press or anything. There's just the single coming out that we didn't know anything about. It was really strange. And there's other stuff too. Like I remember meeting there's a record plugger and he was like, oh, Chris Moyles every day is like singing your song direct hit and asking who was by. He's like, I'm playing on FIFA and it's great. He goes, da 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 da. Like he's like singing it and asking who was buying stuff. Like, that's amazing. Like, so did you phone him and tell him what happened next? And he went, no. He's just like, you're my radio plugger. Surely you're supposed to what? Like, yeah, no one knew and it didn't get played. I'm like, you knew, you were listening. Like, it's your job. Like, all that kind of stuff was like, yeah, that went on. And it was like, oh, this is a nightmare. And then, so we left him. It was like mutual. It was okay. They gave us our album back and stuff. I mean, so many bands that signed to them at the same time. There's a great band called The Little Ones that signed at the same time. Their album just never came out, you know. Paul Tigertail, loads of these great bands kind of got fucked by EMI, sort of signing up loads of indie bands and then going bankrupt. I think lots of them got their albums back eventually. But yeah, we got ours back pretty quick. That's part of the deal, so it was okay.
And then going back to America, so I had some, like, performances on Jimmy Kimmel and Kernan, and is it true? Well, I read that you said that, I think Daniel Radcliffe was one of the guests and he said that you were his favourite band.
Yeah, that was cool, yeah. We were very shy of meeting him on Conan. He was on Conan and he came in and, yeah, to the dressing room and asked to have his photo taken with us. We're like, oh yeah, sure, well, that's okay, but can we have a copy of that photo? Is that all right? Yeah, he goes to the Reading Festival, he told me, like in disguise. And he'd seen us at the Reading Festival and has become a really big fan. I think he likes his other favourite band, he told me then, that day, was the Hold Steady, who we'd just come off tour with. He was like, asking loads about them. Like, you and the Hold Steady are my favourite bands, I wish I could see that tour. Come along. Are you 21? I don't know. But yeah, come on. But he was really super nice. He like had the questions about lyrics and stuff and was really friendly. He was like more mature than us, though, you know. He was like talking to like a man in his 30s or something, you know. Like, and he knew it. He was like, I know I'm very old for my age. Like, my best friend is a cameraman who I play chess with, telling me all this stuff. You know, I was like, he was a cool guy. I was like, I would love to be his friend, but I can't because he's Daniel Radcliffe. He's like this very famous man. Like, I was like, oh, this guy's cool. I'd be his mate if I knew him in any other circumstances. But yeah, he was cool. But it's funny, then like later that year, I guess, he was on again on Conan O'Brien with the Hold Steady. And he was telling Conan O'Brien, like, oh, they're my other favorite band. It's like, you always say that. You said that. No, but like, they are my, these are my favorite. It's very sweet to see that he got to be on with both of his favorite bands at the time. I mean, he probably likes Sleep of Mods now or something. But at the time, it was us. So it's
good. And did you build a bit of momentum in America then? Did you go down quite well there, really?
Yeah. I mean, Germany and America were the places we were doing the best, really. Like, we were on this website. I didn't have a laptop at the time, but on this website called Pitchfork, and that was a big deal. And I think out of that, everything kind of went well for us in America, because they gave us like the third best album of the year or something. And then Yeah, those guys were lovely. Like Ryan from Pitchfork was great. Yeah, we played Chicago a lot. We were always in America. We toured like 3 or 6 weeks at a time, sometimes, like in a big split of an or sleeper bus. Yeah, we did okay over there. Yeah, it was nice, really. We toured with the whole stadium, We Are Scientists, by ourselves quite a lot. Yeah, we spent a lot of time in America. I never saw anything though. Like I was watching Ghostbusters with my son. He's like, have you been to New York? I'm like, yeah, lots and lots of times. And he was like, what's the Statue of Liberty like? Oh, I wasn't there. Like, what's the Empire State? I'm like, oh, I didn't go there. This art gallery, no. I went to like this bar and this bar and that bar. I hadn't been to any of the touristy sort of places.
Yeah, I hear that from quite a few bands, especially, it sounds like that time, there's a lot of press to be done at that time, it sounds like.
Yeah. And I mainly do all the interviews. It became like, we did these run of shows, like, we did like a week when Aubrey versus the third album came out, Aubrey versus Satan. We did like a week in New York, like a week at the, what's it called, the Mercury Lounge, and then a week in Chicago and a week in Los Angeles, like a residency. So we played 5 nights in a row in the same venue each time. And like in Los Angeles, every day my band were like, oh, we're off to the beach now, or like we're off to this other thing, or so-and-so is playing in town, or blah, blah, blah. We're going to go see our friends. And every day I was like, leaving the sunshine to go and sit in a dark room and speak about Harvey. But I don't mind. I like the sound of my own voice. I like continuing. But I wish I'd always like, wish could have had like an extra day on the end of everything for me. It's like, oh, now Eddie wants to go and see his friends. Best. I mean, I was seeing my friends anyway. I'm not really complaining. I had a great time.
And then, yeah, that you mentioned the third album. How does working with Frank Black come about?
Yeah, well, he really liked our second album. We saw it like in a magazine or something, or maybe a TV interview. He was talking about how much Jealous Guy, by Our Brute, sort of song, not John Lennon, by Jealous Guy by Our Brute, was like one of his favorite songs of the year or something. And we're like, well, that's a weird choice, but also that's excellent. And then, yeah, we just kind of asked him. He said yes. Kind of, we're in that moment where we thought we can like ask for things and still get them, you know. We did the same with It's a Bit Complicated. I really wanted to meet Russell Senior, so we got him from Pulp to produce some songs. That didn't work out. But the same trick we did with Cook, and he was on, we signed to Cook and Vinyl, and Black Francis is on Cook and Vinyl, so we had a contact there as well. And yeah, it was great working with him. Like, it was kind of like I said about Oasis, you know, like they're not really a band anymore, they're like a thing, like an institution. He's the same, isn't he? He's like Frank Black, you know, he's written a lot of my favorite songs. So yeah, it was quite intimidating on the way over. Like, does he drink? Hope he drinks. And then the first night we went to a bar with him, and it was super nice. We had this bet, like, because his real name's Charles, like everyone calls him Charles, like who's going to be the first person to accidentally call him Frank Black? And it was me. Like, do you want a drink, Frank? Oh no. He pretended he didn't notice. Yeah, I'm still friends with him now. He did the album after that too, and whenever he's in Berlin, we meet up. You know, when my son was born, he was one of the first people to phone me. He's such a lovely guy. I wrote a book a few years ago, like a memoir, and he wrote the introduction for that. He wrote some really nice things that I might get tattooed on my arm. That's very nice. By Frank Black on my arm. So yeah, he was just so great to work with too. I really like I love the Pixies, of course, but I love the Catholics. And a lot of those albums were recorded in one take, or like two takes. I think everything was in one take, actually. We wanted to do the same thing with us. And he seemed like a good man to sort of trust with that. So he sort of direct us, or change this, or change that. We talk about the songs, and we play them and record them. And like half the time, you go, okay, that's done. Like one take, most of it. It was great. I mean, I've got a very short attention span, for one. So I don't like to do things too often. That's why I change the words live a lot as well. I get bored of the words. And it feels, for me, singing the same thing again and again and again feels like it loses its sincerity, I think. So it was great with him just to sing it once or twice and it's done. That's how I felt in that moment, recorded, finished. So it was, yeah, and he got that really. And I'm not really good at taking advice from people either. And the one person I could probably take advice from is him. I mean, yeah. He wrote a lot of, you know, he's definitely got a lot of experience. Yeah. So from him, I can take advice. So it was the perfect kind of, it worked perfectly, really. And with the rest of the band too, you know, we all, yeah, love him, really.
Was it done quite quickly then, if that was his kind of technique?
Yeah, we did it in like 2 weeks or something. Like before, we had most of the songs, and we sort of finished some there. Wow. I'm always writing the lyrics at the very last minute. So we had most of the music. And then we wrote a few there. Yeah, because I saw a few years ago, the Cribs were like, we've made this album in 2.5 weeks. It's like the special thing. That's how we work, man. That's how our group record records now. Yeah. So yeah, we did it like, yeah, it was less than 2 weeks, I think, actually. We were in Salem. Second one too, we did with him, like less than 2 weeks. It's great. It's really intense. I like it. You know, I'm not very good at, I need a deadline really. So like, I need to be like this, we're recording this song tomorrow. So you have to go and write the chorus now. I need that. So it's, yeah. So for me, it works out perfectly doing it that way. Hopefully we get to do it with him again. We worked with this guy, Jim Murray, on the last record, who I love. Yeah, so either him or Charles Frank Black next time would be great, I think.
Just a bit of a gap between the fourth and fifth album. Like, were you off doing different things at that point?
No, well, what did we do? I would have been saying, oh yeah, like a year later, we did Brilliant Tragic. And then there was a gap. It was like 7 years between the fifth and the... Well, lots of things happened. We did a best of in that time. Mike and Jasper left the band. I had a son. I had perinitis and diverticulitis. I got really sick. I was in hospital for a bit. I moved, yeah, all that kind of stuff. Really, life happened, I think. So that's that. Being sick and having a son were the main things that slowed me down. I'm not really the engine of Uproot. Like, they're always writing songs, but they need me to finish them, you know? So it's, yeah, I think that kind of slowed us down for a bit. I think, yeah, it's weird because Toby, that replaced Jasper in our Brute, has been in the band now longer than Jasper was in the band, but has only released one record because I was like, sorry, Tobes. That kind of slowed us down, I guess. And just, yeah, recalibrating. It's nice. We're writing songs at the moment. It's nice to be. It's not going to be another 7 years. The last thing I said before it was 7 years was, this is our Brute. We're going to release a record every 6 months, every year. And it's like a big 7 year gap. So I'm not going to say that again. But hopefully we're not going to leave big gaps this time.
Yeah, I saw you on tour with the Subways. Was it last year you did that?
Yeah, well, it started before the pandemic, actually. So the pandemic stopped it. It was weird because I was on that tour in the UK with the Subways. Every night we were watching the news, you know, is the show going to happen kind of thing. I've been like crowd surfing and working the merch and hugging everybody. And then it got stopped and I came back to Berlin. And Germany was already dealing with everything very differently. So I've been like, then I've been hugging people and like crowd surfing. I came back to Berlin and everything was shut and there's nobody in the streets. It was really strange. But yeah, so that happened, stopped. And then finally we got to finish it, like, yeah, early this year, September, I think, which was great. And we were like, I want to play again tomorrow. Like, so it was, yeah, I can't wait to like be back. And it was so hard. I mean, I've known Ian in our Brute since we were at school together. We were like 14. That's the longest I've been without seeing him, you know, that big gap. I couldn't go to the UK and he couldn't come here. And then I didn't realize I was going to get so emotional. I didn't cry, but I was pretty, like, in the room with my band again, like, there were tears in my eyes. I was like, oof, I've missed these people a lot, you know.
And, you know, I saw you have a few different other projects. Is Art Brute kind of your main one at the minute?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing a solo record as well with... Do you know the band Toy? Tom from Toy and me are writing some songs together at the moment. And then some of those lyrics work, I think, better with Uproot. So I've got like a big pile of lyrics now. I'm just sort of dividing them between the two projects. So yeah, I'm making the solo record with Tom and I'm writing an Uproot record at the moment. Yeah, over lockdown, I recorded a Bob Dylan covers album. Hopefully that's coming out soon. It's funny, I'm a big fan of Billy Childish and he did the same thing. It's like, oh, damn it. And he got his out first. same idea, but yeah, he beat me. So yeah, so all those things are going on, really. Yeah, I'm always busy with like a million things.
And then I just want to finish on these, got a few stories that I've read you were talking about on NME recently that are very funny, like stories from back in the day. First one, Arctic Monkey story, which involves Ian coming out with a very funny line involving the Kaiser Chiefs.
Yeah, well, this, I think, shows how different everyone in my band is because I was away watching Bell and Sebastian and enjoying Bell and Sebastian a lot, and I came back to the dressing room and apparently when I'd been gone, Mike, our drummer's little sister, had been asleep on the floor and Ian had been sleeping in a chair, and the Arctic Monkeys had thrown a big bottle of champagne over the roof and like shattered things about us, and it over the over the partition, over the roof, and it nearly hit Mikey's sister in the head. And it would have, the big champagne, but it would have really hurt. So Ian picked it up, smashed it, kicked their door in, and said, "Which one of you cunts threw this? You're not fucking with the Kaiser Chiefs now," which I think is kind of amazing. I didn't see that, but I heard that from my dad. But I came back and he'd been like taken away by security. What happened? Well, he did what? Or was it you, trophy head? He said, "You're not fucking with the Kaiser Chiefs now. Go and find the bottle." Like, wow. And I'm watching Belle and Sebastian at the same time.
Yes. And then I laughed out loud at this one. One about the bravery, where I think they were getting compared a lot to the Killers at the time. So you,
I walked up to the. I kept calling them the Killers. I kept walking up to the bravery and calling them the Killers. Hey, and they're like, "We're not the Killers, we're the bravery." And then I would say, "It was an honest mistake," and run away. That was kind of the game I've been playing. I've been doing that a lot, and then I thought, because then. The same festival, but like the week before we'd been at Glastonbury and bands could review other bands, and I'd reviewed the Magic Numbers and made loads of jokes about them being terrible. And at that same moment, I was running away from the bravery. The Magic Numbers had found my band. We're trying to start a fight with them, and so I ran away from the bravery and looked up, and all my band were pointing at me. What's going on? And then the Magic Numbers came to sort of. To rumble with me as well. Don't pick up. They're quite. That was a mistake. Their drummer especially was a pretty solid guy. I wouldn't like to be in a fight with him. But luckily, it got stopped. But yeah. I think I just liked a lot of mischief. I was often in trouble. It's fun, isn't it? I enjoyed all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one that NME latched onto at the time was. Something between you and Kelly from Block Party?
And that followed me around for a bit. Like, well, I can't remember. Like, I didn't have a laptop, you know, really, back then. So in my head, I did an interview for Play Louder. So I was only the internet. No one's going to read that. No one reads the internet. Yeah, I thought, in 2007. And everyone does read it. And I'd slagged off Block Party in the interview. I was very drunk at Glastonbury. So I said, he's always slagging off Oasis, but... It's the same trick, you know, the Block Party just ripping off the Gang of Four instead of T-Rex, you know, and the Beatles. It's still just nonsense about helicopters and chocolate. But then I completely forgot that I'd said it, you know. The next time I saw Kelly, we were playing Tea in the Park, and he was glaring at me. I was like, well, that's weird, what's that about? And then on stage at Tea in the Park, he dedicated Helicopter to me. I was like, that's nice of him. Why is he doing that? And then he went on T4 afterwards. And started, they're like, who's the favourite, who are you looking forward to seeing this weekend or something? And he was like, Fatty Argos. And they're like, who's what? Who's Fatty Argos? And he was like calling me fat on TV. And that's when my friends realised that he wasn't being nice. You've got some beef with Kelly from Book Bike. And it went on for ages. And I was like, oh, that's a bit embarrassing. I sort of forgot about it. And then I was in East London, which I was already embarrassed about because I don't like East London. I've been dragged there. And then he was in this bar and he kept coming up to me and like trying to start a fight with me. And I got really exhausted with him. And I said, look, mate, I shouldn't have said what I said to a journalist, but to be fair, you are a bit moany. And I said, as I did moany with my hand, he punched me in the head and got dragged and thrown out by the bouncers. And then let him back in again to have another go at me, which is really funny, I think. And then they had to do these, people asking us questions about it. It's in the Sun and the Sport and stuff. Like, and they could, it was funny because they said the front man from Block Party punched the singer from Art Brut. But really, it's the other way around, yeah? He's the singer. And then the enemy asked me about it, and I said that it was, you know, you shouldn't be calling me fat, really. That's the kind of comment that killed Karen Carpenter. And he was a dickhead. And then I think I said he was a dickhead, and then it was everywhere. We like tour, we'd be in Canada and open up a magazine and it'd be like, Art Brut say Kelly from Block Party is a right dickhead. It's like, oh, no, it's like I can't ever escape it. It's a nightmare. And then years later, like a few years ago in Germany, here, I was giving an award out, like an award ceremony for some Wellington boots. They were like fashion item of the year or something. And Kelly was there. Kelly won best live performance or best album or something. And I thought, it's been a long time now, you know? So I thought I'd smile at him or sort of wave at him or something. He wouldn't look at me. It was really weird. And on stage, I was like, giving the world, I was trying to smile at him. He still got a bit of a grudge, I think. And then what was really embarrassing is there was free drink at this thing. So I was making my way quite fast afterwards to the free bar and didn't see in front of me, Kelly was just there. And a journalist or a photographer leaned over me and tapped him on the shoulder, like, take a photo. And he looked a bit behind him like that, and he thought it was me tapping him on the shoulder, and he ran off. I was like, oh no, that's really bad. One, I don't really want to speak to you. And two, that's it was just a really awkward, the whole thing. But I thought by now that would have blown over. That followed me for ages, that Kelly from Brook Pike thing. I never punched him back or anything. He just, yeah, swung at me. I mean, I am annoying. It's funny that all those people, he's the one that finally snapped and tried to punch me. The Dominic never punched me. The Magic Numbers didn't get to punch me. The Bravery didn't punch me. Kelly. Yeah, there we go.
Do you think you thought you were going to get your own back when you ran away?
No, I think he just didn't want to speak to me.
Fair enough.
I imagine he doesn't like me. I think, I would guess. So it's, yeah. Funny, I just thought it was nice. Like, we started in the same place. You know, like, the Block Party supported us when they were called The Union, like in New Cross. But they'd already secretly signed a record deal and stuff. They were just sort of, I don't know, doing whatever they do. But the yeah, so I've known him for a long time. It's, yeah. But that'd be like, yeah, another person I've upset.
And then the last one is just one about you giving Paul McCartney a kick up the ass at some point.
Yeah. Well, that was at the NME Awards. I've only ever been, maybe this is why, we've only ever been invited to the NME Awards once. And the rest of our group, only I got a ticket and I felt bad, but I went. And I was sort of by myself. I couldn't talk to many other bands because I'd upset them all. I couldn't like go and hang out with the others or something, you know. So I was up at the bar by myself, drinking.
Did you get put on a random table at that point then?
No, I was like, I was by the door. Oh, so right. I wasn't at it. I didn't get a table. So I was like, yeah, by the bar, really, by the free bar, obviously. And the drinking. I'm trying to make friends. And I still smoked then. And I went in my pockets looking for change for the cigarette machine. I was sort of walking back, was looking at my change. I felt my leg like hit somebody really hard. And I turned around and to like see what it was. And it was Paul McCartney. I kicked Paul McCartney. Hard enough for him to like, you know. So yeah, kicked him in the bum. Well, top of the thigh, I'd say more than the bum. But the, yeah, he didn't say anything. He got rushed off by the people he was with. But it was like, I saw him grimace. I was like, I just kicked Paul McCartney. And also, that was another moment like, am I hallucinating this? Am I? It definitely happened. Yeah. Okay, Paul McCartney. And, I say bunk because it's funny, but it was more the upper thigh.